It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board Wednesday approved Governor Wolf's proposal to waive nearly $28 million in liquor license fees to provide financial relief to restaurants and bars, which have been hit hard by the pandemic, the temporary shutdown, and ongoing restrictions. Chuck Moran is the executive director of the Pennsylvania Licensed Beverage and Tavern Association. Chuck, welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you, Kevin, for having me.
Chuck, this could affect some 16,000 restaurants, bars, clubs, hotels, the lifting of these fees through 2021. I understand it would save about $1,500 apiece. Would that make any difference? Would it help them sustain their businesses?
It's really a dent. It won't go very far, needless to say. But, you know, they've been asked to basically pay 100% of their licensing fees, but they've been told you're not going to be allowed to use 100% of your business rights for the fees that you paid. You know, they've been the tip of the spear since day one. There's no other industry that has sacrificed more for the good of the public health. But this is not going to go far enough, and it needs to be combined with a number of other things.
So can you give us a sense of their overall financial situation?
We did a survey of our members in late August, and at that point, we knew 13% had already closed. We were anticipating another 5% every 30 days. Our poll tracked along the same lines as national polls that say about 70% are going to close up and go out of business. It's even worse. Think of it from the employee perspective. That's a lot of jobs lost. Our average member employs 16 individuals, including themselves. Our survey showed that the average place had to lay off or furlough 13 of those people.
Governor Wolf recently vetoed a Republican-backed bill that would have eased restrictions on taverns and restaurants. One example would be prohibiting serving people at bars instead of tables. Your reaction to the governor's veto?
There are really four parts, one of which was offered by Democrats, non-continuous outdoor seating. That's something the governor vetoed. He vetoed the opportunity to allow establishments to use their bar tops for seating if they followed social distancing properly. There's a rule with that you have to buy food if you want to have a drink. That would have eliminated that. And the fourth part would have allowed people to have a minimum of 50% if they followed social distancing. That was really twisted and was unfortunate. A lot of our members tell us they don't necessarily want a handout. They want to earn it. And unfortunately, with the governor's veto, that didn't happen.
Do you think the governor needs to loosen restrictions, including capacity?
Look at the contact tracing data right now. Out of 2,841 who answered a question about businesses, 61 went to bars. If you look at all businesses, it comes out to be about 17%. That's where I think the data needs to really be investigated, because we know that there's no shortage of kegs, cases, and liquor bottles in any town, particularly college towns. And we feel that these very strict mitigation efforts are driving people to house parties, family gatherings, and so forth like that, where they let their guards down and they relax too much and social distancing isn't followed. Masks aren't being worn. Instead, if the governor had not vetoed House Bill 2513, they would have had a safer option.
So you're saying that bars and restaurants are a safer option because, despite those numbers that you cited most recently, they have been cited as sources for spread during the course of these months?
Yeah, there's no doubt about anything indoor, you're going to increase your risk. But what we're saying is that the increase of house parties and other gatherings, that's also a big source. If we truly want to solve this problem, we got to get to the root of the problem where the data lies. And the data does not have big statistics for bars right now.
Right now being the key.
Right.
So is there a level of frustration for those, your members? And we're talking about basically the smaller businesses. Maybe they are, you know, abiding by the restrictions, but they're feeling the pinch at the bottom line?
Yeah, absolutely. We know from our earlier survey that 71% are having cash flow problems at this point, and they're trying to do everything right. They'll go out, they'll buy, you know, plexiglass to set up, then they'll be told that they can't use the bar stools. And that's damaging in a different way in terms of financials go. But it's something that's very, very frustrating for our members. They are trained with safety issues around food and how to keep patrons safe from disease and so forth. So maybe a little bit of effort by the governor could go a long way in helping this industry.
Governor Wolf said the suspension of the liquor license fees is a step, quote, toward helping bars and restaurants retain the capital they need to weather the storm of COVID-19, end quote. He's proposed $100 million in forgivable loans and grants for the hospitality, leisure, and service industries, including restaurants and bars. Will that be enough to weather the storm, as the governor puts it?
I'm not sure there's any amount of money at this point to keep people to survive through the upcoming months. You know, you can do the math. If there's 26,000 restaurants by itself and 100 million, I'm not sure that goes too far in keeping people employed and keeping mortgages paid and electrical bills paid. There's a number of bills up at the Capitol related to grants, all have a different amount. Hopefully, as we get into the budget, the second half of the budget at the Capitol, that will come out more and we'll know more.
Chuck Moran is the executive director of the Pennsylvania Licensed Beverage and Tavern Association. Chuck, thanks for your time.
Hey, thanks a million, Kevin.
It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In the summer of 2019, Carnegie Mellon University launched the Center for Informed Democracy and Social Cybersecurity, IDEAS, to study how disinformation is spread through online channels like social media. Kathleen Carley is a professor in the School of Computer Sciences Institute for Software Research and is the director of the center. Welcome back to the Confluence.
Hi, I'm delighted to be here.
So over the last 12, 15 months, what has your team been learning about how people have been using technology to basically spread wrong information, even lies, on a mass scale?
Well, we've learned that a lot of the disinformation is actually a global phenomenon spreading from one country to another, that the source of a lot of the bad information is actually these sites that are not real news sites, but they pose as news sites. And so people think that they are reporting from that, and that bots are being used to rebroadcast disinformation, but that most of the disinformation, like if you just looked at how many, like if every 100 messages, maybe 70 of these, those will be spread by people and the other 30 by bots.
Do those numbers surprise you, what you've learned?
We actually thought that bots would be more involved in the daily tweeting of new disinformation. But what we found is that that's surprising how they're used extremely strategically to get out certain types of disinformation.
During 2020, you've had two very big issues to study when it comes to wrong information spread on social media, the pandemic and a very contentious election. Has it been misinformation, errors spread unintentionally, or deliberate disinformation when it comes to the pandemic?
With the pandemic, it's been both. So the actual intentional we call disinformation, and the unintentional we call misinformation. We find that the disinformation has been intentional, and that is the stuff you'll often see from these, you know, fake news sites, and that you'll see bots spreading. And a lot of that has been about conspiracies, about bioweapons, about the pandemic itself being, you know, actually being cured by things like bleach and things like that. Whereas a lot of the misinformation are people respreading stories that they think might be true, like a possible cure or a possible preventative, like eating garlic or drinking green tea. And we also see that kind of unintentional spread of, you know, anything that they think is a sign of hope.
Digital chain letters might they
be? Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Well, earlier this month, Facebook and Twitter said they had taken down more than a dozen disinformation networks used by political and state-backed groups in multiple countries to deceive users on their platforms. They did get some flack for it. So are there some proven ways that social media companies can stop this disinformation?
It's very hard for any one company to stop it because all of the different platforms are interconnected. Like if I went to see something, I use Twitter maybe to improve the number of people who go to see my YouTube account. And then on YouTube, I might put a link to a comment about my Facebook page. And on Facebook, I might get that improved by getting more people to go there by talking about it on Instagram or on, you know, 4chan or some other thing. All of these things are so interconnected that if it's just simply one company decides to stop a particular piece of disinformation, it'll just go to the other channels and then repop back up.
Mm-hmm. So that's what the companies can do. But what can your center do to help, you know, make sure that information out there is legitimate?
Well, first off, we're trying to develop new techniques for actually identifying inaccurate information and inauthentic actors like bots and trolls and so on like that, by trying to provide guidelines out there to, you know, everybody, to, you know, the various communication groups, to journalists, to policymakers, about what to look for and how to, you know, and what the good side as well as the bad side of some of these kinds of events can be. And also helping people understand that a lot of disinformation simply goes away and doesn't have a long-term effect, and that other information, and trying to give them understanding of what kinds of information need to be combated, and if so, how.
Professor, will it always be a game of catch-up that those who want to spread the lies, purposely mislead people, will always find another way?
I believe that it's just part of the human condition that there are always going to be people, you know, spreading lies through different media. The question, I think, is whether it will ever be so, whether we can reduce the extent to which it is overwhelming. Because right now, during the pandemic and during the election, it has, you know, it is at a level of magnitude that we have never seen before. Right? Most elections, there's, you know, a few hundred lies. But this time, we're talking about, between the pandemic and election, tens of thousands of disinformation bits going out there. So I think that we'll be able to reduce that number, but I think you'll probably always have some.
Kathleen Carley is the director of Carnegie Mellon University's Center for Informed Democracy and Social Cybersecurity. Thanks so much for your time.
Sure. Happy to be here.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The two presidential candidates differ sharply on a number of issues. That's especially true when it comes to their stances on the environment. How would these differences affect Pennsylvania? For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier went to find out.
President Donald Trump spent 4 years dismantling over 100 federal environmental rules and policies. So what would a second term for President Trump mean for the environment?
Where do I begin?
Robert Ruth is an attorney with the Clean Air Council, an environmental group based in Philadelphia. The Trump administration has rolled back climate rules set by the Obama administration to curb emissions from power plants, cars, and the oil and gas industry. These have come even as scientists say we need to move quickly to lower emissions or risk the worst effects of climate change.
Another 4 years of the Trump administration and the Trump EPA, I think, would be catastrophic.
The Trump administration has resisted even admitting that climate change poses a problem and has articulated few plans to deal with it. Biden, meanwhile, is calling for a $2 trillion climate plan that would make the economy carbon neutral by 2050. He's calling on Congress to pass some type of climate legislation if he's elected. That could be bad news for the state's coal industry, since coal has the biggest CO2 footprint of any fossil fuel. Rachel Gleason is with the Pennsylvania Coal Alliance. She says a big climate bill is likely if Biden wins.
I would completely think that that would probably happen. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that the Biden-Harris ticket does not have an appetite for the coal industry, and that's a problem.
When he ran in 2016, Trump promised to bring back the coal industry. That didn't happen. Natural gas and renewables continued to eat away at its market share. But Gleason says that by rolling back regulations on coal, Trump has kept the industry from an even steeper decline.
I don't know that we can necessarily argue that there's been an uptick in production and industry, but it's definitely steadied itself until the pandemic hit.
Other industries say they've benefited from Trump's environmental rollbacks, including his changes to the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA. The law requires environmental reviews for federally permitted projects. Kevin Sunday is with the Pennsylvania Chamber of Business and Industry.
From ag to forestry to manufacturing to energy and transportation, basically all the major commodity and industrial segments are going to be at some point touched by NEPA.
Business groups say these reviews take too long, and Trump shortened them. Biden could revoke these changes to NEPA, and he could also reverse Trump's rollbacks of Obama-era regulations targeting the oil and gas industry's release of methane, a potent greenhouse gas. Pennsylvania has state rules that limit methane leaks on wells built after 2018. But Ruth of the Clean Air Council says the Trump administration's moves also put the kibosh on cutting emissions for thousands of wells built before that.
Which are by far the greatest source of emissions of methane right now.
Even without regulations, a potential Biden administration could start to impact the state's natural gas industry, says Artem Abramov, an analyst with the consulting firm Rystad Energy. But Abramov said there would be no sudden effect.
I would not expect that there will be any immediate implications, for producers themselves if we observe this change, in the administration.
Even if he wanted to, Biden couldn't ban fracking in Pennsylvania, Abramov said. And Biden has made it clear he doesn't want to do that. But Biden's plan to boost renewables, like offshore wind projects in the Atlantic Ocean, could hurt demand for natural gas from Pennsylvania.
I think the whole northeastern region will be the first region in the U.S. where gas consumption peaks structurally.
These are some of the reasons why Lisa Johnson is worried about a Biden presidency. She runs Sunnyside Supply, which sells equipment to the natural gas industry in Washington County. She and the rest of her 12 or so employees all plan to vote for Trump.
It makes me very nervous if Biden would get in with his green energy where we stand. And, we might not see it in the first 6 months, but long term over the next 4 years, where will we be?
But others like Anais Peterson say we need to address climate change. Peterson, a recent college grad from Pittsburgh who's working as an environmental activist, says climate change is already happening in Pennsylvania in the form of increased flooding and hotter weather, and in other parts of the world. She's voting for Biden.
I mean, it's very present in our lives, and it's not just about polar bears and ice caps melting, but it's about humanity's ability to survive.
Voters for both candidates say the stakes of this election could not be any higher. Reed Frazier, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. If you enjoy what you're hearing, there's even more to read on our website at WESA.fm, where our newsroom is rounding up everything you need to know about how the coronavirus pandemic is affecting our region and beyond. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at WESA.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Helen Wigger, Tom Hurley, Isabel Schmaler, Julia Zenkovich, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.